This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, and to find out how you can volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Maureen O'Brien, MarieElectrics.blogspot.com. The Spy by James Fenimore Cooper, Chapter 6. And let conquerors boast their fields of fame. He who in virtue arms a young warm spirit against beauty's charms, who feels her brightness yet defies her thrall, is the best, bravest conqueror of them all. Moore. The ladies of the Wharton family had collected about a window, deeply interested in the scene we have related. Sarah viewed the approach of her countrymen with a smile of contemptuous indifference, for she even undervalued the personal appearance of men whom she thought arrayed in the unholy cause of rebellion. Miss Peyton looked on the gallant show with an exulting pride, which rose in the reflection that the warriors before her were the chosen troops of her native colony, while Frances gazed with a singleness of interest that absorbed all other considerations. The two parties had not yet joined before her quick eye distinguished one horseman in particular from those around him. To her it appeared that even the steed of this youthful soldier seemed to be conscious that he sustained the weight of no common man. His hoofs but lightly touched the earth, and his airy tread was the curbed motion of a blooded charger. The dragoon sat in the saddle, with a firmness and ease that showed him the master of himself and horse, his figure uniting the just proportions of strength and activity, being tall, round, and muscular. To this officer Lawton made his report, and side by side they rode into the field opposite to the cottage. The heart of Frances beat with a pulsation nearly stifling as he paused for a moment and took a survey of the building, with an eye whose dark and sparkling glance could be seen, notwithstanding the distance. Her color changed, and for an instant, as she saw the youth throw himself from the saddle, she was compelled to seek relief for her trembling limbs in a chair. The officer gave a few hasty orders to his second-in-command, walked rapidly into the lawn, and approached the cottage. Frances rose from her seat and vanished from the apartment. The dragoon ascended the steps of the piazza, and had barely time to touch the outer door when it opened to his admission. The youth of Frances, when she left the city, had prevented her sacrificing, in conformity to the customs of that day, all her native beauties on the altar of fashion. Her hair, which was of a golden richness of color, was left untortured to fall in the natural ringlets of infancy, and it shaded a face which was glowing with the united charms of health, youth, and artlessness. Her eyes spoke volumes, but her tongue was silent. Her hands were interlocked before her, and, aided by her taper form, bending forward in an attitude of expectation, gave a loveliness and an interest to her appearance that for a moment chained her lover in silence to the spot. Frances silently led the way into a vacant parlor opposite to the one in which the family were assembled, and turning to the soldier frankly, placing both her hands in his own, exclaimed, "Ah, Dunwoodie, how happy on many accounts I am to see you! I have brought you in here to prepare you to meet an unexpected friend in the opposite room." "To whatever cause it may be owing," cried the youth, pressing her hands to his lips, "I, too, am happy in being able to see you alone. Frances, the probation you have decreed is cruel. War and distance may separate us forever. We must submit to the necessity which governs us. But it is not love speeches I would hear now. I have other and more important matter for your attention." "What can be of more importance than to make you mine by a tie that will be indissoluble? Frances, you are cold to me, from whose mind days of service and nights of alarm have never been able to banish your image for a single moment." "Dear Dunwoodie," said Francis, softening nearly to tears, and again extending her hand to him, as the richness of her color gradually returned. "You know my sentiments. This war once ended, and you may take that hand forever. But I can never consent to tie myself to you by any closer union than already exists, so long as you are arrayed in arms against my only brother. Even now, that brother is awaiting your decision to restore him to liberty, or to conduct him to a probable death." "Your brother?" cried Dunwoodie, starting and turning pale. "Your brother? Explain yourself! What dreadful warning is concealed in your words?" "Has not Captain Lawton told you of the arrest of Henry by himself this very morning?" continued Francis, in a voice barely audible, and fixing on her lover a look of the deepest concern. "He told me of arresting a captain of the 60th in disguise, but without mentioning where or whom," replied the major in a similar tone, and dropping his head between his hands, he endeavored to conceal his feelings from his companion. "Dunwoodie! Dunwoodie!" exclaimed Frances, losing all her former confidence in the most fearful apprehensions. "What means this agitation?" As the major slowly raised his face, in which was pictured the most expressive concern, she continued, "Surely, surely you will not betray your friend, my brother, your brother, to an ignominious death." "Francis!" exclaimed the young man in agony. "What can I do?" "Do?" she repeated, gazing at him wildly. "Would Major Dunwoodie yield his friend to his enemies? The brother of his betrothed wife? Oh, speak not so unkindly to me, dearest Miss Wharton. My own Francis, I would this moment die for you, for Henry. But I cannot forget my duty, cannot forfeit my honor. You yourself would be the first to despise me if I did." "Peyton Dunwoodie," said Francis solemnly, and with a face of ashy paleness, "you have told me, you have sworn that you love me." "I do," interrupted the soldier with fervor, but motioning for silence, she continued, in a voice that trembled with her fears, "Do you think I can throw myself into the arms of a man whose hands are stained with the blood of my only brother? Francis, you wring my very heart." Then pausing to struggle with his feelings, he endeavored to force a smile as he added, "But after all, we may be torturing ourselves with unnecessary fears, and Henry, when I know the circumstances, may be nothing more than a prisoner of war, in which case I can liberate him on parole." There is no more delusive passion than hope, and it seems to be the happy privilege of youth to call all the pleasures that can be gathered from its indulgence. It is when we are most worthy of confidence ourselves that we are least apt to distrust others, and what we think ought to be, we are prone to think will be. The half-formed expectations of the young soldier were communicated to the desponding sister more by the eye than the voice, and the blood rushed again to her cheek as she cried, "Oh, there can be no just grounds to doubt it! I knew, Dunwoodie, you could never desert us in the hour of our greatest need." The violence of her feelings prevailed, and the agitated girl found relief in a flood of tears. The office of consoling those we love is one of the dearest prerogatives of affection, and Major Dunwoodie, though but little encouraged by his own momentary suggestion of relief, could not undeceive the lovely girl who leaned on his shoulder as he wiped the traces of her feeling from her face, with a trembling but reviving confidence in the safety of her brother and the protection of her lover. Francis, having sufficiently recovered her recollection to command herself, now eagerly led the way to the opposite room to communicate to her family the pleasing intelligence which she already conceived so certain. Dunwoodie followed her reluctantly, and with forebodings of the result, but a few moments brought him into the presence of his relatives, and he summoned all his resolution to meet the trial with firmness. The salutations of the young men were cordial and frank, and on the part of Henry Wharton, as collected as if nothing had occurred to disturb his self-possession. The abhorrence of being in any manner auxiliary to the arrest of his friend, the danger to the life of Captain Wharton, and the heart-breaking declarations of Francis had, however, created an uneasiness in the bosom of Major Dunwoodie which all his efforts could not conceal. His reception by the rest of the family was kind and sincere, both from old regard and a remembrance of former obligations, heightened by the anticipations they could not fail to read in the expressive eyes of the blushing girl by his side. After exchanging greetings with every member of the family, Major Dunwoodie beckoned to the sentinel, whom the wary prudence of Captain Lawton had left in charge of the prisoner, to leave the room. Turning to Captain Wharton, he inquired mildly,
"Tell me, Henry, the circumstances of this disguise in which Captain Lawton reports you to have been found. And remember, Captain Wharton, your answers are entirely voluntary."
"The disguise was used by me, Major Dunwoodie," replied the English officer gravely, "to enable me to visit my friends without incurring the danger of becoming a prisoner of war."
"But you did not wear it until you saw the troop of Lawton approaching?"
"Oh, no," interrupted Frances eagerly, forgetting all the circumstances in her anxiety for her brother. "Sarah and myself placed them on him when the dragoons appeared, and it was our awkwardness that has led to the discovery."
The countenance of Dunwoodie brightened, as turning his eyes in fondness on the speaker, he listened to her explanation.
"Probably some articles of your own," he continued, "which were at hand, and were used on the spur of the moment."
"No," said Wharton with dignity. "The clothes were worn by me from the city. They were procured for the purpose to which they were applied, and I intended to use them in my return this very day."
The appalled Frances shrank back from between her brother and lover, where her ardent feelings had carried her, as the whole truth glanced over her mind, and she sank into a seat, gazing wildly on the young men.
"But the pickets? The party at the Plains?" added Dunwoodie, turning pale.
"I passed them, too, in disguise. I made use of this pass for which I paid, and as it bears the name of Washington, I presume it is forged."
Dunwoodie caught the paper from his hand eagerly, and stood gazing on the signature for some time in silence, during which the soldier gradually prevailed over the man, when he turned to the prisoner with a searching look as he asked,
"Captain Wharton, whence did you procure this paper?"
"That is a question, I conceive, Major Dunwoodie has no right to ask."
"Your pardon, sir. My feelings may have led me into an impropriety."
Mr. Wharton, who had been a deeply interested auditor, now so far conquered his feelings as to say, "Surely, Major Dunwoodie, the paper cannot be material. Such artifices are used daily in war."
"This name is no counterfeit," said the dragoon, studying the characters and speaking in a low voice. "Is treason yet among us undiscovered? The confidence of Washington has been abused, for the fictitious name is in a different hand from the pass. Captain Wharton, my duty will not suffer me to grant you a parole. You must accompany me to the Highlands."
"I did not expect otherwise, Major Dunwoodie."
Dunwoodie turned slowly towards the sisters, when the figure of Frances once more arrested his gaze. She had risen from her seat, and stood again with her hands clasped before him in an attitude of petition. Feeling himself unable to contend longer with his feelings, he made a hurried excuse for a temporary absence and left the room. Frances followed him, and obedient to the direction of her eye, the soldier re-entered the apartment in which had been their first interview.
"Major Dunwoodie," said Frances, in a voice barely audible, as she beckoned to him to be seated. Her cheek, which had been of a chilling whiteness, was flushed with a suffusion that crimsoned her whole countenance. She struggled with herself for a moment and continued, "I have already acknowledged to you my esteem. Even now, when you most painfully distress me, I wish not to conceal it. Believe me, Henry is innocent of everything but imprudence. Our country can sustain no wrong." Again she paused, and almost gasped for breath. Her color changed rapidly from red to white until the blood rushed into her face, covering her features with the brightest vermilion, and she added hastily in an undertone, "I have promised Dunwoody, when peace shall be restored to our country, to become your wife. Give to my brother his liberty on parole, and I will this day go with you to the altar, follow you to the camp, and in becoming a soldier's bride, learn to endure a soldier's privations." Dunwoody seized the hand which the blushing girl, in her ardor, had extended toward him, and pressed it for a moment to his bosom. Then, rising from his seat, he paced the room in excessive agitation. "Francis, say no more, I conjure you, unless you wish to break my heart." "You then reject my offered hand?" she said, rising with dignity, though her pale cheek and quivering lip plainly showed the conflicting passions within. "Reject it? Have I not sought it with entreaties, with tears? Has it not been the goal of all my earthly wishes? But to take it under such conditions would be to dishonor both. We will hope for better things. Henry must be acquitted, perhaps not tried. No intercession of mine shall be wanting, you must well know. And believe me, Francis, I am not without favor with Washington." "That very paper, that abuse of his confidence to which you alluded, will steel him to my brother's case. If threats or entreaties could move his stern sense of justice, would Andre have suffered?" As Francis uttered these words, she fled from the room in despair. Dunwoody remained for a minute nearly stupefied, and then he followed with a view to vindicate himself and to relieve her apprehensions. On entering the hall that divided the two parlors, he was met by a small ragged boy who looked one moment at his dress, and placing a piece of paper in his hands, immediately vanished through the outer door of the building. The bewildered state of his mind and the suddenness of the occurrence gave the major barely time to observe the messenger to be a country lad, meanly attired, and that he held in his hand one of those toys which are to be bought in cities, and which he now apparently contemplated with the conscious pleasure of having fairly purchased by the performance of the service required. The soldier turned his eyes to the subject of the note. It was written on a piece of torn and soiled paper, and in a hand barely legible, but after some little labor, he was able to make out as follows. "The Wrigglers are at hand, horse and foot." Footnote. There died a few years since, in Bedford, Westchester, a yeoman named Elisha H. This person was employed by Washington as one of his most confidential spies. By the conditions of their bargain, H. was never required to deal with third parties, since his risks were too imminent. He was allowed to enter also into the service of Sir Henry Clinton, and so much confidence had Washington in his love of country and discretion that he was often entrusted with the minor military movements, in order that he might enhance his value with the English general by communicating them. In this manner, H. had continued to serve for a long period when chance brought him into the city, then held by the British, at a moment when an expedition was about to quit it, to go against a small post established at Bedford, his native village, where the Americans had a depot of provisions. H. easily ascertained the force and destination of the detachment ordered on this service, but he was at a loss in what manner to communicate his information to the officer in command at Bedford, without betraying his own true character to a third person. There was not time to reach Washington, and under the circumstances, he finally resolved to hazard a short note to the American commandant, stating the danger and naming the time when the attack might be expected.
To this note he even ventured to affix his own initials, E.H., though he had disguised the hand, under a belief that as he knew himself to be suspected by his countrymen, it might serve to give more weight to his warning. His family being at Bedford, the note was transmitted with facility and arrived in good season, H. himself remaining in New York. The American commandant did what every sensible officer in a similar case would have done. He sent a courier with the note to Washington, demanding orders, while he prepared his little party to make the best defense in his power. The headquarters of the American army were, at that time, in the Highlands. Fortunately, the express met Washington on a tour of observation near their entrance. The note was given to him, and he read it in the saddle, adding in pencil, "Believe all that E.H. tells you. George Washington." He returned it to the courier with an injunction to ride for life or death. The courier reached Bedford after the British had made their attack. The commandant read the reply and put it in his pocket. The Americans were defeated and their leader killed. The note of H, with the line written on it by Washington, was found on his person. The following day, H was summoned to the presence of Sir Henry Clinton. After the latter had put several general questions, he suddenly gave the note to the spy and asked if he knew the handwriting, and demanded who the E.H. was.
"It is Elijah Haddon, the spy you hanged yesterday at Powell's Hook."
The readiness of this answer, connected with the fact that a spy having the same initials had been executed the day before, and the coolness of H., saved him. Sir Henry Clinton allowed him to quit his presence, and he never saw him afterwards. Dunwoody started, and forgetting everything but the duties of a soldier, he precipitately left the house. While walking rapidly towards the troop, he noticed on a distant hill a vedette riding with speed. Several pistols were fired in quick succession, and the next instant the trumpets of the corps rang in his ears with the enlivening strain of "To arms!" By the time he had reached the ground occupied by his squadron, the major saw that every man was in active motion. Lawton was already in the saddle, eyeing the opposite extremity of the valley with the eagerness of expectation, and crying to the musicians, in tones but little lower than their own, "Sound away, my lads, and let these Englishmen know that the Virginia horse are between them and the end of their journey." The vedettes and patrols now came pouring in, each making in succession his hasty report to the commanding officer, who gave his orders coolly and with a promptitude that made obedience certain. Once only, as he wheeled his horse to ride over the ground in front, did Dunwoody trust himself with a look at the cottage, and his heart beat with unusual rapidity as he saw a female figure standing with clasped hands at a window of the room in which he had met Francis. The distance was too great to distinguish her features, but the soldier could not doubt that it was his mistress. The paleness of his cheek and the languor of his eye endured but a moment longer. As he rode towards the intended battleground, a flush of ardor began to show itself on his sunburnt features, and his dragoons, who studied the face of their leader as the best index to their own fate, saw again the wonted flashing of the eyes and the cheerful animation which they had so often witnessed on the eve of battle. By the additions of the vedettes and the parties that had been out, and which now had all joined, the whole number of the horse was increased to nearly 200. There was also a small body of men whose ordinary duties were those of guides, but who in cases of emergency were embodied and did duty as foot soldiers. These were dismounted and proceeded by the order of Dunwoody to level the few fences which might interfere with the intended movements of the cavalry. The neglect of husbandry which had been occasioned by the war left this task comparatively easy. Those long lines of heavy and durable walls which now sweep through every part of the country 40 years ago were unknown. The slight and tottering fences of stone were then used more to clear the land for the purposes of cultivation than as permanent barriers, and required the constant attention of the husbandman to preserve them against the fury of the tempests and the frosts of winter. Some few of them had been built with more care immediately around the dwelling of Mr. Wharton, but those which had intersected the vale below were generally a pile of ruins,
over which the horses of the Virginians would bound with the fleetness of the wind. Occasionally a short line yet preserved its erect appearance, but as none of those crossed the ground on which Dunwoodie intended to act, there remained only the slighter fences of rails to be thrown down. Their duty was hastily but effectually performed, and the guides withdrew to the post assigned to them for the approaching fight. Major Dunwoodie had received from his scouts all the intelligence concerning his foe which was necessary to enable him to make his arrangements. The bottom of the valley was an even plain that fell with a slight inclination from the foot of the hills on either side to the level of a natural meadow that wound through the country on the banks of a small stream, by whose water it was often inundated and fertilized. This brook was easily forded in any part of its course, and the only impediment it offered to the movements of the horse was in a place where it changed its bed from the western to the eastern side of the valley, and where its banks were more steep and difficult of access than common. Here the highway crossed it by a rough wooden bridge, as it did again at a distance of half a mile above the Locusts. The hills on the eastern side of the valley were abrupt, and frequently obtruded themselves in rocky prominences into its bosom, lessening the width to half the usual dimensions. One of these projections was but a short distance in the rear of the squadron of dragoons, and Dunwoodie directed Captain Lawton to withdraw with two troops behind its cover. The officer obeyed with a kind of surly reluctance that was, however, somewhat lessened by the anticipations of the effect his sudden appearance would make on the enemy. Dunwoodie knew his man, and had selected the captain for this service, both because he feared his precipitation in the field, and knew when needed his support would never fail to appear. It was only in front of the enemy that Captain Lawton was hasty. At all other times his discernment and self-possession were consummately preserved, but he sometimes forgot them in his eagerness to engage. On the left of the ground on which Dunwoodie intended to meet his foe was a close wood, which skirted that side of the valley for the distance of a mile. Into this, then, the guides retired, and took their station near its edge, in such a manner as would enable them to maintain a scattering but effectual fire on the advancing column of the enemy. It cannot be supposed that all these preparations were made unheeded by the inmates of the cottage. On the contrary, every feeling which can agitate the human breast in witnessing such a scene was actively alive. Mr. Wharton alone saw no hopes to himself in the termination of the conflict. If the British should prevail, his son would be liberated. But what would then be his own fate? He had hitherto preserved his neutral character in the midst of trying circumstances. The fact of his having a son in the Royal, or, as it was called, the Regular Army, had very nearly brought his estates to the hammer. Nothing had obviated this result but the powerful interest of the relation who held a high political rank in the state, and his own vigilant prudence. In his heart he was a devoted loyalist, and when the blushing Frances had communicated to him the wishes of her lover on their return from the American camp the preceding spring, the consent he had given to her future union with a rebel was as much extracted by the increasing necessity which existed for his obtaining Republican support as by any considerations for the happiness of his child. Should his son now be rescued, he would, in the public mind, be united with him as a plotter against the freedom of the states, and should he remain a captive and undergo the impending trial, the consequences might be still more dreadful. Much as he loved his wealth, Mr. Wharton loved his children better, and as he sat gazing on the movements without with a listless vacancy in his countenance that fully denoted his imbecility of character, far different were the feelings of the son. Captain Wharton had been left in the keeping of two dragoons, one of whom marched to and fro on the piazza with a measured tread, and the other had been directed to continue in the same apartment with his prisoner. The young man had witnessed all the movements of Dunwoodie with admiration mingled with fearful anticipations of the consequences to friends. He particularly disliked the ambush of the detachment under Lawton, who could be distinctly seen from the windows of the cottage,
cooling his impatience by pacing on foot the ground in front of his men. Henry Wharton threw several hasty and inquiring glances around to see if no means of liberation would offer, but invariably found the eyes of his sentinel fixed on him with the watchfulness of an Argus. He longed with the ardor of youth to join in the glorious fray, but was compelled to remain a dissatisfied spectator of a scene in which he would so cheerfully have been an actor. Miss Peyton and Sarah continued gazing on the preparations with varied emotions, in which concern for the fate of the captain formed the more prominent feeling, until the moment of the shedding of blood seemed approaching, when, with the timidity of their sex, they sought the retirement of an inner room. Not so Frances. She returned to the apartment where she had left Dunwoodie, and from one of its windows had been a deeply interested spectator of all his movements. The wheeling of the troops, the deadly preparations, had all been unnoticed. She saw her lover only, and with mingled emotions of admiration and dread that nearly chilled her. At one moment the blood rushed to her heart as she saw the young warrior riding through his ranks, giving life and courage to all whom he addressed. And the next, it curdled with the thought that the very gallantry she so much valued might prove the means of placing the grave between her and the object of her regard. Frances gazed until she could look no longer. In a field on the left of the cottage, and at a short distance in the rear of the troops, was a small group whose occupation seemed to differ from that of all around them. They were in number only three, being two men and a mulatto boy. The principal personage of this party was a man whose leanness made his really tall stature appear excessive. He wore spectacles, was unarmed, had dismounted, and seemed to be dividing his attention between a cigar, a book, and the incidents of the field before him. To this party Frances determined to send a note, directed to Dunwoodie. She wrote hastily with a pencil, "Come to me, Peyton, if it be but for a moment." And Caesar emerged from the cellar kitchen, taking the precaution to go by the rear of the building to avoid the sentinel on the piazza, who had very cavalierly ordered all the family to remain housed. The black delivered the note to the gentleman, with a request that it might be forwarded to Major Dunwoodie. It was the surgeon of the horse to whom Caesar addressed himself, and the teeth of the African chattered as he saw displayed on the ground the several instruments which were in preparation for the anticipated operations. The doctor himself seemed to view the arrangement with great satisfaction, as he deliberately raised his eyes from his book to order the boy to convey the note to his commanding officer. And then, dropping them quietly on the page, he continued his occupation. Caesar was slowly retiring as the third personage, who by his dress might be an inferior assistant of the surgical department, coolly inquired if he would have a leg taken off. This question seemed to remind the black of the existence of those limbs, for he made such use of them as to reach the piazza at the same instant that Major Dunwoodie rode up at half speed. The brawny sentinel squared himself and poised his sword with military precision as he stood on his post, while his officer passed. But no sooner had the door closed than, turning to the negro, he said sharply, "Harkee, harkee, if you quit the house again without my knowledge, I shall turn barber and shave off one of those ebony ears with this razor." Thus assailed in another court member, Caesar hastily retreated into his kitchen, muttering something in which the words "Skinner" and "rebel rascal" formed a principal part of speech. "Major Dunwoodie," said Frances to her lover as he entered, "I may have done you injustice if I have appeared harsh." The emotions of the agitated girl prevailed, and she burst into tears. "Frances," cried the soldier with warmth, "you are never harsh, never unjust, but when you doubt my love." "Ah, Dunwoodie," added the sobbing girl, "you are about to risk your life in battle. Remember that there is one heart whose happiness is built on your safety. Brave, I know you are. Be prudent."
"For your sake?" inquired the delighted youth.
"For my sake," replied Francis, in a voice barely audible, and dropping on his bosom.
Dunwoodie folded her to his heart and was about to speak as a trumpet sounded in the southern end of the vale. Imprinting one long kiss of affection on her unresisting lips, the soldier tore himself from his mistress and hastened to the scene of strife. Frances threw herself on a sofa, buried her head under its cushion, and with her shawl drawn over her face to exclude as much of sound as possible, continued there until the shouts of the combatants, the rattling of the firearms, and the thundering tread of the horses had ceased. End of chapter 6.